Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Chinese President Hu Jintao sat down with President Obama in Washington to talk global nuclear issues yesterday. The photo op, these two sitting together, is, in a way, the symbol of our moment. Two big powers on a world stage. What might Hu Jintao think if he walked out into the streets of America, really got an eye and earful? Today, we'll ask New Yorker writer and China watcher Peter Hessler what he saw when he came home from years in China. And we'll get a Chinese view. This hour, On Point America, seen from China. Later this hour, we'll talk about Iraq and its future with reporter Anthony Shadid, who just won the Pulitzer Prize for international reporting on Iraq. And we'll hear in a few minutes from a young Chinese woman who's been moving back and forth between the United States and China. But joining me first from Grand Junction, Colorado, is Peter Hessler, staff writer at the New Yorker magazine. He's known for his deep observation of Chinese life in his books Rivertown, Oracle Bones, and his latest, Country Driving. We spoke with Peter a few months ago about his whole China sojourn. Now he's writing about his return to the United States. He's been in Colorado since mid-2008. His latest New Yorker piece is Go West, Scenes from an American Homecoming. Peter Hessler, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks so much. Great to be here.
So everybody knows that there's culture shock when one goes abroad, and when they're abroad as long as you were, there's culture shock on the homecoming, too. Give us a just sense of what was it like coming back into this country from pretty much booming China.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's been an adjustment. I mean, I actually first left the United States right after college, basically, in 1992. And there were a few stretches where I was back in the States for a number of months, but I never made a full-time home here from that time, you know, until about spring of 07. So I was overseas for about 15 years, mm-hmm. It's an adjustment, and that means also that I was away during a lot of these very big events that, you know, that we think of as really having defined America in recent years. I mean, I was overseas for 9/11 and, you know, for all the Bush years, and so, you know, it's felt to me like, you know, reconnecting with something that was once familiar but is now less so.
And, of course, this was a time when China was in the midst of its epic ascent. You write in your latest piece in The New Yorker that the Chinese were extremely curious about the United States. Give us some sense of that curiosity and maybe some of the assumptions around it.
Yeah, I mean, this is something. I first went to China in 1996 as a Peace Corps volunteer, and I was one of two Americans in a city of about 250,000 people. There were no other foreigners there. And so you do get a lot of attention as an outsider in a place like that. And people, one of the first things that you sense is just this incredible curiosity. I mean, this is a culture that was isolated for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And people really were hungry, you know, and they still are. They're hungry to know more about the outside world. They're very curious about living standards and about economics tends to be, you know, one of the main themes. I mean, everybody in China, when you meet people, they always ask you, you know, how much money you make, what's your salary like, how much does this cost, how much does that cost? So a lot of the questions are pretty practical, pretty practically oriented. But there's also a lot of ideas they have about what life is like in the States. You know, for example, when I was teaching, many of my students had heard that, you know, families aren't as close in the States, and it's an individualistic and selfish society. And so they would ask me questions like, when you have dinner with your parents, you know, if after the meal is over, do your parents give you a bill, or do the elderly, you know, if the elderly parents visit their adult children, adult children charge them for the meal? I mean, there's a lot of questions like that.
Just try that. You'll be in trouble. Or you had some asking if it was true that American farmers were so rich they use airplanes to plant their crops. And,
yeah.
And one, you quote a college student who wrote an essay. In an essay, if you want to go to heaven, go to America. If you want to go to hell, go to America. What did your student mean by that?
Well, he's just talking about this sense that America is a land of extremes. And the example that he had given in that essay, he had asked me, he said, you know, I've heard that in America, guns are so common that beggars on the street have to wear bulletproof vests. You know, and it's sort of, you know, it's one of these things that's exaggerated. But, you know, there's a bit of truth there. It is true that guns are easily accessible in America. And the same thing, even the farmers and the airplanes. Well, there are some parts of America where farmers use airplanes in, you know, in different ways, sometimes even for planting, but certainly for crop dusting. And so, you know, it's often makes it very hard to talk about the U.S. there because, you know, when it's abstract, you know, it's more of a concept. It's more of an idea than it is a place or a group of people. And so, yeah, I often found myself trying to push people away from the extremes. America is not paradise and America is not hell, you know, and life is, you know, there's a lot of people living in the middle. And that was generally what I tried to push people toward when I talked to them. But, you know, it's hard when it's an abstract concept.
So turn it around, Peter, and begin to bring it home for us. I had maybe a similar experience myself a few years back, coming home from 10 years in Asia. You had 15 in China and came home at a time when things had really changed there and in some ways changed here. What did this country look like to you with your kind of Chinese eyes on coming back?
Yeah, I think one of the things I really notice is regional differences. I mean, and in a way, this is kind of counterintuitive because we have the sense of China. You know, everybody knows that China has a lot of dialects. It's linguistically very complicated. This is a place where traditionally there's a lot of differences between regions. But the truth is that when you're there on the ground, I mean, this is a country that has had one party for more than 50 years and, you know, pretty heavily regulated education system and media system. And so major opinions do not vary a lot in China. You know, if you want to ask somebody, a Chinese citizen, about Tibet or about Taiwan or some sort of fundamental issue like that, you're not going to hear a big range of opinion. And one thing that I really noticed moving back to the States is that, you know, despite the fact that everybody here speaks English pretty much, you know, there's just an incredible shift when you go from place to place. I mean, I live in a small county in southwestern Colorado. And I mean, last year for 4th of July parade, the guest of honor at the parade was Joe the Plumber, you know, and that's not going to happen in New York or in Boston, you know. And so the ideas that I hear from people here are totally different from the ideas that I would hear, say, on the East Coast or on the West Coast. I think that sort of regionalism in the U.S. is much stronger than I had remembered. You know, it was something I'd kind of forgotten by being in China.
You're writing about this homecoming in The New Yorker, so we've got all the nuance we expect there. But give us just the kind of down and dirty. Did America look, feel competitive to you coming from China?
You know, that's sort of a complicated question. It certainly feels slower. You know, there is not that sort of drive and energy that you feel in China. You know, there's people in China are really pushing. You know, there's no question about it. It, you know, it's a very tangible sense. You get it on the street. And certainly if you get to know people and talk to them, you can see the drive. In the States, you don't have that as much. And people don't talk as much about what they do, about their jobs. You know, people talk more about their hobbies and their interests. You know, but it's also true that this is a very functional society. And there's a lot of ways in which society functions better when people are not so hard-edged, you know, and you notice that in America. I mean, I wrote this book about driving, and driving's a lot easier in America, partly because people are willing to give a little bit. You know, and you see this a lot in daily life. If you're standing in line, you're trying to get something done at an office, everybody doesn't have to be 100% charging forward all the time. And, you know, and sometimes that makes things easier. I feel like that's actually one of the steps for China in the future is, you know, to sort of create a culture where, you know, people can be a little more comfortable and perhaps a little nicer to each other.
Comfort is nice. Niceness is nice, but there's competition too. Your wife came back with you from China. I mean, did you look at each other when you came into that more comfortable USA and say, oh my gosh, this country's toast?
I guess sometimes you have that feeling. It is true that sometimes you think, you know, it's really hard to compete. But then you realize also that the competition is not direct. And I think this is one of the things that's very hard for Americans to understand, I think, is that, you know, we can't compete with China when it comes to low-cost manufacturing. There's absolutely no way. You know, and it's not even a currency issue. They can revalue the currency to a huge degree. And they just, you know, they simply have more workers and more unskilled workers. But that's not necessarily the way that we've been competing with China or competing with the outside world. I mean, I think what the U.S. has to offer is much more along the lines of innovation, you know, and creating sort of value-added goods rather than just basic things. And what does it take to create those things? I mean, part of it is, you know, having a comfort level with people, certainly having an education system. You know, when I return to the U.S., I do find that I'm generally, you know, despite everybody's always saying that the education system is falling apart, I do find it, you know, much more refreshing after what I saw in China. You know, an education system that's pretty hidebound, very traditional, and very politically controlled.
In China.
In China, yeah. You know, and in the U.S., for all the flaws, I mean, this is a system where students can think for themselves and where students are encouraged to innovate and are encouraged to use their imagination. There's a lot of problems, no doubt about that. But, you know, I think it's not as dire as a lot of people make it seem.
And just look, talking with Americans, do you have a sense that they're in the game? Are Chinese actively thinking about competing in the world stage? Do you hear Americans with that active sense that, you know, it may not be just one-to-one, but there's a rumble underway here?
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I mean, I think that educated Americans are quite conscious and quite conscious of China. And if you talk to people who are educated, and especially people in the coastal cities, they will often ask you a lot of questions. One thing we noticed moving to a small town in Colorado is that people weren't that interested, you know. And we would often go to bars and talk to locals. And when we told them, you know, we're writers who lived in China for the last 10 years, well, first of all, we would say, you know, we've been overseas for more than 10 years, and people would always say, oh, were you in the military? You know, because
right,
in most
right.
parts of America, that's the only reason that you'd be overseas,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, it's kind of depressing. But then, you know, people didn't have that many questions, or they aren't that curious. I mean, I think that is a problem in the U.S., you know, that there is, you know, there's a level of curiosity among, you know, a certain class and certain group of educated people. But among average Americans, I think there is a lot less interest.
President Obama was in Asia and China, and just last fall he talked with a group of young people in Shanghai there about how the U.S. was looking at China's increasingly large role in the world.
Power in the 21st century is no longer a zero-sum game. One country's success need not come at the expense of another. And that is why the United States insists we do not seek to contain China's rise. On the contrary, we welcome China as a strong and prosperous and successful member of the Community of Nations.
President Obama in Shanghai. This week, Chinese President Hu Jintao met with the president in Washington. Afterward, Ma Zhaojiu, spokesman for the Chinese delegation, emphasized that U.S.-China economic issues were front and center in their meeting. Tensions have been rising lately over currency and trade issues. This is from China's state-run CCTV.
Hu said the sound and stable development of China-U.S. economic and trade ties is good for China, for the United States, and for the world economic development. China and the United States should properly solve the economic and trade rifts through consultations on an equal footing and jointly uphold the larger interests of China-U.S. economic cooperation and trade.
All about cooperation there, but these are two countries and two big countries and two big cultures meeting one another. With me right now in the studio here in Boston as well is Jia Cheng. She's a young graduate student at Harvard Business School. She's moved back and forth between the two countries and cultures, doing business with McKinsey & Company and Goldman Sachs, American companies. She grew up in Shanghai, graduated from Fudan University. Jia Cheng, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom. My pleasure.
So when did you first come to the United States? What was your first visit? How long ago?
My first visit was 8 years ago in 2002. At that time, I was sponsored by, at that time, the Vocovia Bank to do a culture and education exchange program in North Carolina.
Okay, so you've been back and forth a lot and a lot more recently. You've lived in China in subsequent years and come here. How do you think? I mean, for you, for your Chinese compatriots, when they visit the U.S. now, what most strikes you?
Well, I think this topic is quite grand and quite overwhelming, so I would shed some light on, based on my limited personal experience, mm-hmm. which is currently focused on business school education and previously focused on my employment with several of my few previous companies.
Well, you've been around. You've been in North Carolina. You've been here and there in the U.S., so we know you've got a pretty good sense.
Right, right. So I would just point out two very minor micro moment mm-hmm. that I first encountered in the U.S. back to 2002.
Great.
So the first thing I feel is that the service is very expensive.
So, what kind of service?
So the service that you want to have someone to help you do something, basically.
Carry a bag at the airport or...
Correct. Like moving your furniture, like finding a apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to basically do everything by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
However, compared to China, I mean, the labor supply is so huge.
You've got always low-wage people coming in from the countryside, very available in Chinese cities for that kind of help, I guess.
Correct. In a way that it constituted a market so that you can very freely choose the affordable and accessible service, manpower service.
But here you're kind of on your own, as you say.
Right, right. It's quite a challenge, especially for a woman, I mean.
So you're used to having, I mean, in a way for Americans, this may sound like the United States in, I don't know, 100 years ago when there were many more immigrants and maybe folks from the countryside who could be hired by city people to help them do all kinds of things. That's a difference. What else? Another micro moment?
Another micro moment actually is when I first went to a local club with several of my United States friends.
Mm-hmm.
So in China, what we normally do between friends is that we go to a good restaurant or a karaoke place.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes when I was in Hong Kong, some of my friends, we will organize a hiking trip
mm-hmm.
that we start with some good food and good drink. But in the States, I was took by some of my friends to a local restaurant or a bar. And for the next 4 to 5 hours, I was just sitting there and chatting with each other, but only with a cup of beer. And I didn't remember that there is any choice of like even chicken tenders or chicken wings on the menu. So it seemed that, to me, it seemed that American people like to chat a lot. Back to Peter's point, he pointed out just now.
Mm-hmm.
However, they seem to not put so much emphasis on the quality of like cuisine and accompanied when you are having the conversation.
Peter Hessler, you're listening in Colorado. I wonder how you're hearing this. One of the things you've written about recently in the magazine, The New Yorker, in your latest piece, was that the community life in China was in some ways much more overwhelming. You could feel kind of alone in this country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people in China are much more group-oriented, you know, and you really notice this, you know, as a reporter and as a writer. I mean, the way that it jumps out for me is the way people talk. And, in China, I learned that it's, you know, people talk a lot. People are very social and engaging, but they don't like to talk very deeply about themselves. And as a reporter, I learned that I had to spend a lot of time with people, sometimes, you know, visiting them repeatedly for months before I would really learn much about their stories. And, you know, in the States, it's striking to me, especially living in southwestern Colorado, that there's, you know, much more solitude in the States. I think there's something about this solitude, you know, as I mentioned, this New Yorker essay, there's something about that solitude that makes people more talkative, actually. And so when you do meet people, they will often tell you their story very quickly in the States. It's almost, you know, it's almost disarming. I mean, the very personal things that people will tell you. I mentioned the story, you know, a guy comes over to put in the DirecTV in my house, and we just have a conversation. He says he lives in a small town. I say, oh, why'd you move there? And he very quickly is telling me it's because he had a son who was less than 1 year old who died.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to get out of the place he was living before to get rid of the memories, you know. And
wow.
And this is the sort of thing that somebody in China just would not tell you that on first meeting, you know, and it sort of happens repeatedly in the States. And, you know, as somebody coming back from being overseas, it often took, you know, I'm often a little taken aback. My reaction might be a little more Chinese in some ways, and
mm-hmm.
I don't really know how to respond. But, you know, people in America are talkative. They're storytellers. I think this is connected to the individualism, you know, and a lot of it does come down to population. A lot of these issues, you know, are very much affected by how many people are around you. It's like the point that John made about the service economy is, you know, is clearly connected to how many people there are in China.
Right. Jiacheng, what about it? Americans and their candor. Do you feel that? Conversations, people being more open and honest here quickly than you might find in China? Is that your experience?
My personal experience is that in China, it is more common for people who are defined to know each other for a long time to chat about very deep topic,
mm-hmm.
very candidly,
personally.
And vis-a-vis in the States, it's like everything is like a very rigid process. For example, if I meet you, Tom, in the first day, we can chat like just in a processing line about what you grow up, what you used to do, and but that's it. It's very difficult to build momentum that we can talk a little bit more deep into a lot of a lot of topics,
mm-hmm.
unless we have known each other for a long time. So I think that candor in both of the country, both build on the mutual trust.
Maybe because you're Chinese, they don't think you want to get personal. I don't know. I'm not sure. What about Americans always describe themselves as free? Do you sense a cultural, a political freedom in this country that's unusual?
You mean in the States?
Yes.
Well, from the experience that I live here, I personally didn't feel quite a lot of difference compared to my experience living in Hong Kong and Shanghai. Maybe here I'm a little bit biased because I came from Shanghai, which is to some degree a typical kind of
city. Prides itself on being more individualistic and more free in a way.
Well, which is built upon its solid economic kind of business practice.
Mm-hmm,
But actually, I didn't feel a lot of difference compared to my working experience and living experience across the three regions.
Peter, how about you on that front?
I think there's certainly there's a big difference. I mean, as a writer, I would say that, obviously what you can write and, professionally in the U.S. and China, there's a big difference there. I think as far as what people feel is a different issue. And the question of freedom, there's a lot of structural freedoms that you have in the States, like freedom of press, complete freedom of religion, so on, that you don't have in China.
Mm-hmm.
But how does that affect people? How do they think about it? Does it weigh on them? I think that's in many ways the core issue. And I would say that the people that I knew in China did not go about their lives thinking, I'm not able to publish whatever I want. That's not necessarily the top priority for the average Chinese citizen. So I would agree that most Chinese people do not feel like their freedom is greatly curtailed. I think that if Americans were trying to function that system, it would bother Americans because we're accustomed to certain things, and certain things, are values right now that are not yet values in China. And also in China, there is an incredible economic freedom, and it's probably, the economic freedom is probably greater than it is in the U.S. in many respects. And right now, at this generation, the average Chinese person's interests are much more economic. And I think that's one reason why they generally feel quite free, because for what they care about right now, they do have a lot of mobility. They can change jobs very quickly. They can start businesses easily. There's a lot of opportunity. So, I think, the perception is often, is often what matters.
We have so many callers waiting to come in. Peter Jiacheng, please stand by. Let's go to Los Angeles first, California, and Victor. Victor, you're on the air.
Hi, good to everybody.
Hi.
An observation, in China, I fly to Shanghai and I drive over to Suzhou, where you have a tremendous economic boom. And when you talk about their economic freedom, it is tremendous, their economic freedom. People do work and they do make money, and it's interesting to see what they do with their money, because on weekends they do what we've exported to China, and that's to consume as much as they possibly can afford. So what we've exported to China is the American idea to consume and to consume, and they do, and it's interesting to say. One other observation is that when my first experience was in Suzhou, a typical person came over to me and asked me, do all Americans tote guns? They really perceive us as being a very aggressive people and very violent. They do hear the news, and they do hear about, people being killed in the United States. They have this perception all Americans carry guns. I don't know if that's because of Hollywood, but it's just an interesting observation.
Victor, we're glad for both of those. Thanks very much. Jiacheng, what about this issue of Americans and their guns? Before you came or when you go back, is that people's sense in China? Americans are all armed and ready to fire?
Well, at least my understanding is that most of my friends won't ask these kind of questions. Well, but I agree that the perception that you observed actually could exist in China, because in a lot of the movies and the news which are broadcasted on internet, we did see quite a lot of the stories that someone took a gun to the school and killed somebody just to, without any kind of legitimate reasons. The first demand from a person would be the demand for safety and security. So in that sense, even when I was at the high school in Shanghai, actually, every time I heard about this kind of stories, I would feel, this is something really outrageous, because normally you shouldn't be allowed to just take a gun. You shouldn't have the rights to take a gun to take the other people's life.
A little Hollywood and a lot of reality,
right,
there.
That kind of impression might have been shaped in a way that is exaggerated by stories and also movies. Mm-hmm. But yes, this is a natural reaction.
Let's get a call from China, from Beijing, China. Lucia, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a really simple observation. I worked for the past 15 years for environmental and non-governmental organizations, 5 years for the Sierra Club in the United States, and then now I work for a Chinese-registered NGO here in Beijing.
Yeah.
And my experience basically has been that in China, as an environmentalist, there's a feeling that the government sort of gets it. It gets the bigger problem that we're working with the government. And I think there's a lot of times when, you know, we definitely want the government to do more and to go further. But in general, there's a sense of nationalism that underpins the environmental movement. And a lot of young people, I think, reflect that. You kind of feel like you have a front row seat on history, and that you're sort of like on the cusp of the wave of a very new and very big movement. Whereas in the United States, you know, it's had a feeling of being kind of a David and Goliath type of battle, and that as an environmentalist, I felt as if I was attacking freedom. You know, that I was working against our country and against the government, and the process of lobbying and legislation in the United States, you know, left me feeling very small and sort of very empowered, as it does here in China.
Lucia, we're very happy for your call from Beijing. Thanks a lot for that. Peter Hester, what are you hearing that? An NGO, you know, Lucia feels like she's working with the government in China. Of course, we know China's government is also very wary about some NGOs, but in the U.S. feels like she's working against the government or the tide.
Well, I think part of it is that, you know, the political system in the U.S. is complicated, you know, and it's, you know, it changes often. You know, officials are elected regularly and, you know, the tide can change. I mean, in some ways, we always think, you know, Hu Jintao is coming to America. And so, you know, it's really hard for us to understand this place. But, you know, if you think about it from the other side, it must be very hard for Chinese officials to really analyze what's happening in the States. I mean, think about it. If you're a government official in China, you're coming to this country, you know, you're wondering, you know, well, what does this Tea Party thing mean? Is Obama going to be around in 3 years? You know, there's a lot of different strains that are going on in America. It's much more volatile, I feel like. I think that's part of what she's referring to. It might be harder to get things done in our current political system here in the States. So I always think it's kind of an envious, you know, it's not an enviable task for them to try to figure this place out. You know, we think China's really complicated and hard to understand, but, you know, I think politically America's really, really tough, actually.
And that sense of being on the cusp of the cutting edge of history that Lucia has in Beijing, did you feel that there, Peter? What about when you came home?
Well, I think certainly you can tell this is a really key moment in China. You know, I mean, this was something, I mean, you know, the first time I went there, I was traveling in 1994, and I really had no interest in China before I arrived. And really, almost from the moment I got there in Beijing and then traveled through China, I could just tell, you know, there's a sense of energy that things are really changing, things are really happening. And that's been true for more than a decade. So I think it's one of those sort of rare moments in a country's history where they are sort of deciding what they're going to become. And we're not, you know, we can't see where that road is going to go, but we can see where some of these early steps have taken them. So I think in a way it is probably a more vibrant period than this particular period is in the States. In the U.S., a lot of patterns have been set, and we're trying to work within those patterns.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today as Chinese President Hu Jintao visits Washington about how the U.S. looks from China. We'll also talk in a few minutes to Anthony Shadid, who just yesterday, it was announced, won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting on Iraq this year. Let's get a call from Narragansett, Rhode Island, and John. John, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. I was in China in 2007 teaching with the Cultural Exchange Program. And I was there about 7 or 8 weeks. That was a short period of time. But when I got back, I couldn't believe the sense of freedom I had in America. Just to give an example, you know, I thought of the court system. I said, you know, my tax dollars pay for the courthouse. I own the courthouse, and the judges receive tax money, and I pay the judges, and the lawyers report to the judges. And it just if you go to court, it seems that they're trying to judge whether you're living up to responsibility as a citizen. And it seems that as an American citizen, you know, there's nothing between us and the universe. Whereas over there, you know, I just felt that people were very concerned about what the Communist Party or its members thought and what they did, and that they generally seemed to be pervasive in their control of what people did. And I'm sure you can have economic freedom over there, but if you cross one of the people in the party or the party's goals, I don't think you're going to have economic freedom.
John, let us pick it up right there. Peter Hester, what do you say?
Well, you know, I think that's partly a reflection of teaching. I think it's true that when you, because when I first arrived in China, it was as a teacher. Education in China is, you know, pretty hidebound, and it's pretty controlled, you know, pretty strictly controlled by the party. And, you know, during the 10 years that I spent in China, the most that I felt the party's weight, the most that I felt the political system were the 2 years that I spent as a teacher, you know, much more so than when I was a foreign journalist, even though sometimes I was reporting on sensitive topics. Mm. You know, it's a big difference from the States. I mean, in the States, we have this idea of, you know, education being quite liberal, and U.S. students are often quite liberal, and then as they get older, they get more conservative. In China, it's sort of the opposite. You know, colleges are very conservative, very hidebound. Students tend to be nationalistic and conservative. But what happens as they get older is quite different. You know, I taught from 96 to 98. I'm still in touch with about 100 of my former students. Mm-hmm. And as they were very nationalistic, and sometimes it was hard for me as a teacher to deal with that. I've noticed as time has passed, they become less so. Their views are more nuanced, that they are not as nationalistic, they are not as conservative. And this is because they've had contact with the regular society. And it's also because they are no longer having, you know, the regular sort of meetings that they had to have as students. So, you know, some of it depends on your starting point and on your perspective there.
Yeah. Let's go to Sarasota, Florida, and Nancy. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the coming home part that Peter was referring to.
Mm-hmm.
I taught in Taiwan for a year. I taught very intensive. I lived in the dorm with the students. These were adult people who were going off into the entrepreneurial world.
Okay.
And we would go out and they would pick my brains. We would talk about all kinds of life, philosophical things. And I just was drowned in this extremely wonderful atmosphere of having my brain picked. And, of course, I would ask them questions back because they were adults. They mm-hmm. certainly was a fairly equal playing field, except I was twice as old as some of them. Mm-hmm. And when I came home, I was just devastated because I came home to an empty house, and there just wasn't that social network that was so wonderful that I had built in the...
And in a way, you weren't the star attraction, I suppose, in the same way anymore. They had a lot to ask you there. So does that mean America's lonely, or you were just kind of in an overwhelming particular situation there, Nancy?
Well, I've been overseas in a couple of places,
yep.
a lot of Southeast Asia, and it happens every time. Every time I come home, it's terrible. So just because there is so much to absorb. I mean, that's the point. If you go overseas and you're willing to absorb, you're just going to come back. I think it doesn't make any difference who you are.
Absolutely.
You're just gonna come back culture shocked.
Yeah. It happens. It happens again and again. Our time is short. Let me get one more. Indianapolis, Indiana. Ed, you're on the air, Ed.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you know, Ed?
Well, I have been in China within the last couple of years, and have been president of a national professional organization some years before that, and which allowed me to travel around our country and get a microcosm of what's going on in a particular area. And the thing that struck me about China was the electricity, if you will, of the society. They are, as your callers and guests have indicated, very economically oriented. I stand in some fear for our country that we are so self-absorbed in what's going on economically in our country now that we're going to lose sight of where we are in the world, if you will.
Not the same electrical charge in the air. Peter, did you find that?
Well, I think it's true that there is much more of a sense of drive and movement in China. You know, I do think there are still lots of things in the U.S. that are pretty special and that I recognize from living in China. I mean, I think, again, the way the education system is structured, the emphasis on innovation and creativity.
In the U.S., you're saying?
Yeah, in the U.S. This is something that the individualism of the culture kind of allows and facilitates, and also just independent institutions. You know, I find that in China, you know, you don't have, you know, it's still quite hard to get something started outside of the government, outside of business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wrote about this in my book when I was going to a new economic zone where they're building factories, and that's really everything is strictly economic. You don't see somebody building a church or a temple or a library or a park. You know, and those are really important parts of life, and it's not just a way to let people relax. I think it also frees them up for other types of thinking. You know, I think this is still an advantage in the States. I think we are in a moment now where people are very pessimistic. This is a time in the States when, you know, a lot of people are down, and China is not like that. I mean, it's true that the Chinese generally have a very optimistic sense, you know, but how much of this is perception versus reality is another issue.
Jia Cheng, when you look around the States, you know, coming out of Shanghai, do you see a slow country? Do you see history? Do you see the country that it feels to you like China is passing by?
I want to share another micro moment when I was walking on Newbury Street in Boston downtown.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it was a very sunshine day, mm-hmm. very good weather, clear sky, beautiful. But when I was walking on the street, I feel quite lonely because in the first place, there are not so many people on the street. There are beautiful buildings, mm-hmm. very quite different from what I saw in Shanghai, which is like more modern. The buildings here are classic style. Very classic in style.
On this particular street in a very historical city,
correct,
in the U.S.,
correct.
But without that shoulder-to-shoulder crowd of a Shanghai street, certainly.
Certainly. And to me, I'm a person like really a absolutely social person. I like to be with a lot of people. And so in terms of me, I feel quite uneasy when I was walking, wandering actually on the Newbury Street. But after that, when I came back to China during the spring break, when I'm working on the street with a lot of people going around here and there, I don't know how, but it was just a feeling come out of my mind that I was so happy to be a citizen, to live in that city and country.
You're a businesswoman, a fairly high-powered Chinese businesswoman. Do you look at the United States and the U.S. economy now and think, oh, you know, That's going down. China will rule. China will overtake the U.S. China is the future, or something else?
Well, I actually agree with Peter's point on this particular part that both of the nations has their own distinctive comparative advantage. So I used to major in econ in Fudan University, and mm-hmm. the way I think of it is that U.S. still has a lot of the power on innovation, technology, on a certain area of the value chain, for example, high-tech,
mm-hmm.
Biotech, alternative energy, while China, on the other hand, is catching up quite quickly on manufacturing, agriculture, service industry, and also a certain portion of the high-end value-added chain service. So the way I look at it, I personally feel is that the priority of life and the fundamental drive for passion between these two countries are a little bit different. So in China, people just want to live better tomorrow than the status quo. So they mm-hmm. are very empowered to change the status quo. They are very open to take risks and learn from outside. They are just to have huge curiosity to learn from every country, every mm-hmm. part of the world, to learn the things that could learn from to improve themselves in order to create them a better future, have better safety, better health care, can afford their children and parents.
In the U.S.?
In the U.S., actually, people pursue, the way I see it is people pursue more about their passion because they have the real personal interest or intellectual curiosity, or they want to have a trial to make things different by themselves.
Not necessarily economically driven.
Correct. Or not necessarily they want to pursue a sense of security that can bring them different level, different layers of economic security.
Fascinating. Wonderful to have both of you with us today. We'll be thinking about all this as we see the images of Chinese President Hu Jintao in Washington this week and in the weeks and years ahead. Jia Cheng, studying at Harvard Business School, native of Shanghai. Thank you very much for coming in today. Thank you, Tom. And Peter Hessler, back from China himself after many years now in Colorado. His latest book is Country Driving. He joined us today from Grand Junction, Colorado. Peter, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, we'll talk with reporter Anthony Shadid, who yesterday won the Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of Iraq. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Anthony Shadid is one of the world's great foreign correspondents. That was affirmed again yesterday when he won this year's Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. It was Shadid's second Pulitzer and his second Pulitzer for coverage of Iraq and the Iraq War. He's been a regular guest here at On Point. We wanted his thoughts today on Iraq and its future. Anthony Shadid joins us now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Tony, thanks for being here and congratulations to you, sir.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. You've
done it again. I think you've got a new baby in the family as well. It's been a big few days here, Tony.
It has been an interesting few days, I have to say. The baby arrived on Saturday, and then I heard word of the Pulitzer yesterday. So definitely an interesting few days.
That is pretty great. Now, you won it for reporting on Iraq, and that is no doubt a credit to your great reporting. Do you think it's also the Pulitzer Committee trying to say, let's keep paying attention to this country, Tony?
Yeah, I wondered about that. Actually, it did cross my mind that this was a statement in a way that, you know, there is another war going on, obviously, in Afghanistan, but the war in Iraq has not ended. And I think there is kind of a sense out there among, you know, it's interesting when you're in the States that you have this sense that the war has come to an end. That's a very linear narrative. Elections, a new government, the Americans withdraw. But I think when you're in Baghdad, when you're in Iraq, you realize that it's not quite as linear. It's much more precarious. Much more is at foot. Everything is still in play all these years later after the invasion.
So on this day when we're celebrating your big prize, take us beyond that linear narrative. I mean, you've been in Iraq not so many weeks ago. What do you see going on there now, Tony?
You know, it's interesting to me. It's like a lot of 2009 or last year and even now today reminds me of 2003, the first year I was in Iraq with the Washington Post. You know, back in 2003, everything just seemed to be in flux. There were new forces shaping the country. A new government, a new society in some ways was taking shape. I think what we see today in 2009, 2010 is a whole new set of forces that are doing the same thing to the country. They're not the same things we saw back in 2003 necessarily, but the forces are, I think, just as great. They're just as sweeping in how they are reshaping things. Rules have been set down. I mean, rules have been set down by the Americans over the years, sometimes in imperial fashion. But I don't think there's a sense in Iraq today that anybody's going to play by those rules necessarily. And that remains so precarious. It remains so undetermined.
How about stability? I mean, that's what an awful lot of people here think about at this point. Please, please, please let Iraq be stable, however it wants to work that out. Do you see that coming? Or in that flux, do you see more upheaval? Certainly, if we go back to 2003, there was a lot of terrible upheaval coming down the road.
That's exactly right. And I think that's what, you know, I think what strikes me, you know, there have always been these competing narratives out there about Iraq. And I think the narrative that you often hear from this administration, for instance, is that Iraq is on this, you know, on this path toward greater stability, a new government, the Americans can leave. I think when you're in Baghdad, like I said, I think the sense now is that it could go anyway. It is precarious. It's not clear that the prime minister, who didn't do as well in the election as he had hoped to, is going to surrender power peacefully. It's not clear that a coalition can come together to bring stability. I think in some ways, and I, you know, at the risk of overstating it, but I think in some ways you could say this period ahead is as unsettled as any period that we've seen since the invasion in 2003.
Wow. And what about Iraqis themselves? When you speak with them, are they beginning to have enough breathing room to get some philosophical perspective on what just happened to their country in the last, 6 years, decade, you name it?
Exactly. And, you know, that's another thing that always strikes me, I think, just being a reporter in Baghdad, is sometimes, you know, perhaps in the United States, we don't appreciate how much we've actually wrought. in Iraq and how to what degree that society has been ruptured. And I think that, that idea of a torn fabric, of a torn social fabric, is still very much a part of life in Iraq. It's hard to meet anyone in that country that doesn't have a relative or a friend who's been killed. That takes a lot of time to recover from. It's an incredibly traumatic experience. As in the States, after 2001, after the September 11th attacks, there's so many emotions. They're competing emotions, and you still have those competing emotions in Iraq today. You know, people were enthusiastic about the election. I think they are enthusiastic about actually having a choice. I think at the same time, they do worry about what's ahead. They do worry about people not surrendering power peacefully. And they're wondering how this is all going to come together once the Americans do withdraw.
And that date grows nearer by the week now, at least in some substantial portion. Anthony Shadid just won his second Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of Iraq. He joined us today from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Tony, thank you. Congratulations, and thank you very much for being with us. Special day for you. Congrats to you, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Anthony Shadid, now of the New York Times, did a lot of that reporting for the Washington Post. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. Always great to have you with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, RTI International, a nonprofit research and development organization celebrating 50 years of serving governments and businesses worldwide. More information at rti.org. The Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help families earn it, keep it, save it during Financial Literacy Month on the web at aecf.org. And the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the isms are flying in the age of Obama. Charges of socialism, communism, let's define terms. We'll look at what's on the table and what's not. Plus, we look at the world's greenest cities and how a greener planet can start where population is most dense. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.